The choir already preached this sermon, so I'm sorry that I actually wrote this. But since I did, I will deliver it today. All around New England, you will find old churches sharing their lands with graveyards, either beside or behind the building itself. This is a classic characteristic of churches from another era. So I was surprised when I affiliated with a congregation due north of New York City in Westchester County to discover that the pattern persisted even there. The building itself was a striking instance of mid-century modern American architecture. All angles and slanting roofs, situated high on a hill, surrounded by trees and trails and even a brook. If you took one of the trails that started just outside the sliding glass doors to the church, you would find it leading you to the memorial garden. As its name suggested, the memorial garden was not a cemetery. It was a place where the ashes of the departed were scattered or interred, and it was lined with plaques that listed their names and years alive. There were benches overlooking the garden, and I was fond of them. Sometimes near the end of fellowship hour, I'd walk out to them and take a seat. I was hardly ever alone sitting there. The relatives of the deceased would be there already, quiet and still. So I would keep silent company with them, outside in what I consider the alternate fellowship hour. It frequently felt like the most reverential moment on any given Sunday. All my life, though, I found myself at ease in graveyards. One of my earliest memories is of my father taking my older brother and me to the cemetery where our mother was buried. It was some distance from the church where her funeral mass was held, but still on the same small island where we resided. Because my mother died in an automobile accident when I was an infant, I had no conscious memories of her. My father wanted her grave to stand for something, and to this day it does, all the more since my father was buried beside her there some 20-odd years ago. My situation was different from the neighboring children's I recognized for two curious reasons. First, I always knew that someone was dead, or rather had died, so I did not learn lessons about mortality from a goldfish or hamster as kids often do. And second, however strangely, I understood myself to be a child of both the living and the dead. For these reasons, it was never truly startling for me to learn of death, and I never learned to be scared of it. I did not even ask religion to account for it. The marks of earliest human religions we observe are noted in how and where people conduct the burials of their dead. The theological understandings came much later, after the basic rites had been established. It mattered tremendously that our ancestors knew what to do when a life had ended. It didn't ask them to make sense of itself, and maybe we shouldn't ask them today. Religious scholar and best-selling author Elaine Pagels notes in her memoir, Why Religion, A Personal Story, that our religious impulse is always tangled with an awareness of our mortality. Raised in a largely secular household, Dr. Pagels developed a fascination with religion in her adolescence, and that only deepened when a teenage friend of hers was tragically killed. She asked existential questions with a fresh urgency. Where do the dead go, she wonders in her book, and how to go on living, alert to death's presence, its inevitability. In graduate school, she studied and searched ancient scriptures with an eye to meaning-making we mortals have been attempting for millennia now. While she was still a student, she met a physicist who would later become her husband, a man of science who had little patience with superstition. Why religion, of all things, he asks her. She recalls an exchange she had with a relative stranger at a social event. When asked, do you believe in life after death? Her husband replies, yes, of course, but not my life after my death. When the two of them had a child born with a rare and incurable disease, however, questions of death felt present to the couple in especially painful ways. Their boy was just learning about life, and it seemed an impossible task to try and teach him about death at the same time. What surprised Dr. Pagels was the intuitive understanding he already seemed to have of it. Near the end of his life, when she was putting him to sleep one night, he told her, "I'll love you all my life and all my death." She could scarcely believe it. After her son died, Dr. Pagels and her husband struggled with a psychic agony profoundly known by parents who have lost a child. Often she was tempted to second-guess the medical decisions they had made on his behalf or the requests he made that they were not able to fill during his brief time alive. To begin to release the weight of the guilt, she concludes, "I had to let go of whatever illusion of control it pretended to offer, and acknowledge that pain and death are as natural as birth, woven inseparably into our human nature. Yet our human nature resists that acknowledgement so mightily. We are easily seduced into becoming strangers to death until it comes close and suddenly intrudes into our own lives." Dr. Pagels and her husband adopted two children, first a daughter and then a son, and began another stage of their life together. Then, while they were all away on family vacation, the unthinkable happened, and her husband was killed while hiking. The Colorado officer who brought her the death notification tells her, "God never gives us more than we can handle." Of course, the assertion infuriated her. How could it not? No doubt several of you here today have heard some similarly well-intentioned but ultimately insensitive condolences after your own losses. They tend to raise more questions than they answer. For her part, Dr. Pagels stubbornly refuses to believe that old bride that death will teach us some spiritual lesson that will prove invaluable. "Am I religious?" Dr. Pagels asks in her memoir. "Yes, incorrigibly by temperament, if you mean susceptible to the music, the ritual, the daring leaps of imagination and metaphor, so often found in poem, liturgies, and stories." She was not religious in the way many speak of it today. She did not put any personal stock in the existence of an afterlife. The God of her understanding was not in the business of cutting lives short. After keeping her husband's ashes in the bedroom they shared for several months after his death, Dr. Pagels made a decision in the fleeting instant to surrender them. She brought his remains to the Episcopalian priest she knew in New York City, and with minimal ritual, they interred his ashes where her son's remains had been buried, down in the dovecote in the lower level of the Church of the Heavenly Rest. Afterwards, she thought, so that's what we're living now, life after death. But how to go on? That's a question we each have to answer for ourselves at some point. Remembering her own husband's determination, Dr. Pagels declared, "I would have to go on to stand on the side of life," as he often said of people that he respected. Already an established author, she rebuked a friend's suggestion that she write about her grief. Instead, she determines to continue to write about religion, guided by this instinctive inquiry. Where are they, those who aren't here, now lost to us? And where do we locate them in relation to ourselves? Dr. Pagel has written about religion in the decades since those deaths and has never kept her grief out of her understanding of it. In that fusion, she teaches us all a valuable lesson. Long after she earned her doctorate there, Harvard awarded her an honorary degree. Sitting in Harvard Yard in late spring during the celebratory commencement, she muses, "How, I wondered, how had I managed to pass the real tests, the tests I could never have imagined surviving, those unimaginable losses." Today in the sanctuary, I wonder, how have any of us managed to pass them? Our rite of remembrance this Sunday is meant to remind us that somehow we all have. We found no meaning in our son's death or in the death of countless others, Dr. Pagels admits. The most we could hope for was that we could create meaning. Together, we here can continue to create meaning around our losses. Dr. Pagels is right that life after death keeps us alert always to death's presence, aware of our own mortality and of the mortality of those we love. And she's right, too, that birth and death are inseparably part of the human condition and equally natural. It is clear that these cross-cultural rituals of remembering the deceased had their deepest roots in earth-centered religions, marking that powerful seasonal turn from autumn to winter, the time that proved hardest to survive. Those of us who consider ourselves religious people, maybe some in here, are obligated to honor the full reality of our losses. Loss itself cannot be lost on us. It must be something we incorporate in the way we go on living, into our how as well as into our why. The losses we have sustained, of our spouses, perhaps, or lovers, of our parents or our children, of our sisters or brothers, uncles or aunts, of our dearest friends and non-human companions, of our near neighbors or our personal heroes, the catalog continues, seemingly endlessly. They all matter. They matter terribly. The old churches understood something that our newer churches may have forgotten. Late in the 19th century, when the fashions of the times were changing and cemeteries were moved away from central spots in our municipalities to more remote ones, entire families would make the trip, but not before packing up picnics, because they planned to spend the entire day or evening with the dear departed, until that practice eventually became forbidden, either by law or rule or custom. Yet to remain strangers to death is nothing less than to remain strangers from ourselves and in the end from one another. It is not good for us to maintain too great a distance. My childhood intuition was correct. Each of us has descended from the living and the dead and been sustained by them, too. In the more than 15 months since I've been settled here as your minister, I've officiated at more memorial services in this sanctuary than I would have cared to. Yet each one has been precious, and each life and loss has been paid the tribute to it, however complicated the grief was, however complex the relationships were by the end. Only twice have I made the trip to the local cemetery, though, and each time it was a sacred sojourn. When I walk through our church courtyard here at UU Wellesley Hills, I often pause at the benches named in someone's honor, the stones laid in their memory. We do not have a graveyard on our grounds, but we have a place for our beloved dead here. Today, we bring their names and histories inside this house of worship, out of the cold and into the warmth, and honor them at our communal altar. Since our departed have come home to us, we have come home to one another. And for this brief moment, at least, our fellowship feels complete, because it is. Why is religion still around in the 21st century, Dr. Pagels asks, for days such as this? For days precisely such as this. Please rise in body and spirit for our final hymn this morning, number 103, For All the Saints.